Hey, welcome to Perspectives Online and on Air from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this program was pre-recorded on Tuesday, May 26th. That means, of course, we can't take calls or emails. We're not to that point yet, but we're still hoping that aspect of the program will return at some point. Still, it's very nice to have you with us, for sure, and we hope that you will like what you hear and also see online. You know, in the past few weeks, both the New York Times and the Washington Post, among many other respected outlets, have tracked a kind of disturbing component to the COVID-19 pandemic. And that is, even for those who avoid the physical infection, the fear of infection, along with enforced isolation and disruption in so many of our life routines, and even some of those political adversities that have been exacerbated by the situation, these have meant a lot more stress, conflict, and an increase in mental health issues. And there are many reports of more suicides and suicide ideation, in other words, thinking about suicide. Also hostility and violence and depression and substance abuse. It's a long list of bad things. And yet many sufferers are now more reluctant to seek help in a time when any kind of close human interaction can carry dangerous or potentially deadly consequences, for sure. So on this week's Perspectives, we thought a panel of the area's mental health experts might be able to shed some more light on the matter and suggest ways that all of us can cope more effectively, and also tell us what resources in our area are ready, willing, and able to help. So let's go around and meet all our panel. We'll start down in the lower left-hand corner with Jay Reeve, President and CEO of the Appalachie Center, and one of the busiest guys we know when it comes to multiple Zoom calls. How you doing, Jay? Good to see you, sir.
Doing okay, Tom. Thank you for having me on. This is a terrific panel. I'm honored to be among my fellow panelists. And, you know, I always love being on Perspectives. And this is such a crucial topic right now to start talking about and looking at the mental health aspect and the emotional aspect of what's happening with COVID-19, what's happening with social isolation, and what's happening with folks coming on back as we start to reopen.
Thank you so much. We appreciate that, Jay. Right next door to you, Nancy O'Farrell, Executive Director of NAMI Tallahassee. NAMI, the acronym for National Alliance on Mental Illness. And thank you so much, Nancy. It's good to see you, too.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here and maybe share some of what we're doing from the peer point of view, since NAMI is all about folks who have lived experience, to try to support each other while we struggle through to whatever the other side is going to end up looking like. We're getting a lot of feedback from our families and from folks who do have challenges with their mental health that this is really, really tough.
Appreciate you. You could make some time for us on that score, for sure, Nancy. Randy Nicholas also joins us, president of 211 Big Bend. I'm sure getting calls out the wazoo right now, if I can use a term on that. Randy, it is always good to see you, sir. How you been doing?
I've been doing good. Thank you, Tom. Look forward to sharing some information about what we're doing on the hotline and how we're helping people find resources in the community, as well as kind of helping them stay calm with their anxiety.
Well, one of our favorite resources, of course, Sally Carryout, the longtime faculty member of the Florida State University College of Nursing, also internationally known expert on grief, trauma, stress, and compassion fatigue. Sally, thank you so much for coming on board. It is a delight, for sure.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
Well, first, let's go around, and since we're with you, Sally, here, you just graduated a host of folks here out of the College of Nursing, students who no longer could essentially walk up on the stage over at the Donald L. Tucker Civic Center and get those documents and that accolade and all that kind of thing. How have your students been reacting to the fact that this is a major life event that many of them probably feel cheated out of right now?
Well, I've actually got students from all over campus. I teach some general survey classes, and so I'm most concerned about my nursing students who are graduating, taking state boards, and are going to be working on the front lines. But what I tried to do after spring break and they weren't coming back is I had 115 students at that time, and I also had a group that was supposed to leave for London the day that the university shut down. and they had been planning this for at least a year. So that was a stunning disappointment. But what I did with the students was, for the up until the day of graduation, I wrote to every single one of them every single morning and every single night, just so they knew I was there. Sometimes a funny cartoon, sometimes something that was going on. And I set no guidelines for when work was due. I said, whenever you're ready to hand it in, just give it to me and we'll work from there. I taught two speech classes. So students ended up giving their final speeches to their parents. One girl gave it to her parents and her stuffed animals. And I didn't think the hippopotamus was paying attention, so I had to take a few points off. But I think the content and the idea that they were still connected to school every day. And I sent them a little message about once a week. And the last one was that when we are done with this, the world will look different. But the story you're going to tell about your graduation is certainly going to be more interesting than had you walked across the stage. And the other thing I tried to tell them is all of what we're learning now, and I think that the trauma about all this is no one has an answer. We don't know. If someone says, what should we do? None of us know what to say to that. Is that what they're doing now, all of us are doing now, is making a playbook for when things like this happen in the future. And that's a big responsibility and one that's important and one that I want them all to think in terms of what role they have in this.
Because certainly since whether it is the great influenza pandemic of 1918 or the ascendancy of polio back in the mid part of the last century, we have not seen anything like this. You're right. We're kind of writing a playbook as we go. I think at Jay Reeve, we used to call it what? Building the airplane as we're flying it. Is business up at the Appalachian Center? How are you folks handling a situation that our physical hospitals are still kind of in a wait and see mode? Yes, there are some cases. It's not the surge that we thought. Thankfully, at least not yet. What's going on with the Appalachian Center as the primary purveyor of mental health services in this region?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Tom. It's been real interesting. First, really good news is that so far we have had no confirmed cases of COVID within our clients or our staff. And we have done a fair amount of testing. We're doing screening all the time. We're taking temperatures twice a day with both clients and staff. So far, you know, knock on wood, we're okay, which is a good thing. We do have some, not medical isolation, but some removed units set up and set aside in case we do have cases that develop. But for our residential and our inpatient clients, so far, so good. And that part of what we do has not actually seen a lot of fluctuation, with one exception. We've seen a little bit of drop off in terms of our inpatient business from what it typically would be at this time of the year, but it's not huge. So it's really kind of, we're seeing about the numbers of people that we would expect to see. Now, some of what's happened has been that we have had to hold some folks for longer because Florida State Hospital, as many of you on the call know, actually shut down for a while there. So that meant the folks who were waiting to go there from our crisis stabilization unit and from Eastside Psychiatric Hospital had to kind of stay with us. But we've been able to manage that without a ton of difficulty. On the outpatient side is where things have gotten really interesting. Because of course, what happened immediately after the COVID wave started was that we saw this huge drop off in folks coming in for appointments, and we didn't really want folks to come in. We wanted to figure out a way to connect with them so that we weren't doing it face to face. And so we took a movement that had been going on for a number of years towards telemedicine and, you know, just put it on rocket fuel. So at this point, about 85% of our outpatient appointments are being done through telemedicine. And we've figured out ways to do that point to point so people can actually call from their smartphones to our offices, who then route them to our prescribers who are at home. And, you know, we're kind of making it all work. We have not seen an enormous uptick in emergency calls. Now, I think that's a little different than what Randy's experienced at 211, as I'm sure he'll talk about. But part of the reason for that is that folks tend to call the Appalachian Center when there's a mental health crisis. Like, that's what they know is going on, that there's a mental health crisis. And what we know from previous large-scale trauma experiences, whether it's hurricanes or, you know, the World Trade Center attacks at 9/11, is that the real surge for us in mental health is probably going to hit in about 6 months. We would not expect it right now. We wouldn't expect an immediate upsurge in trauma reactions. We're going to be looking for that in the fall, because that's when folks will have been living with this for long enough, and that's when some of the symptoms are going to set in. So we're kind of bracing for that right now.
Well, before
so that's our update.
Okay, before we go up and talk to Randy about what's going on here as far as the 2-1-1 Big Ben situation is concerned, Nancy O'Farrell, that was a beautiful handoff from Jay Reeve, in that NAMI Tallahassee is now also doing its seminars, its workshops, its group settings online, and you're in charge of one of those. How has that been working, and is it as effective, do you think, as the in-person regular kinds of group situations that we're so used to?
Well, first of all, we are not offering any classes online, primarily because our volunteers who teach those classes really don't want to do them in any but the in-person setting. If you're teaching someone an 8-week course, and the synergy in the room is really important and so on. So what we are doing via Zoom are our support groups, one of which is for families of people who have mental health conditions, and the other is for those peers themselves. What we have discovered is that we have really good, better than in-person attendance from the peers. Kind of a silver lining of all of this is that we are now able to reach some folks who don't have the transportation to make it to the in-person meetings. An awful lot of peers, sometimes they're living on disability, they don't have cars, from our rural counties, and we're basically partnering with the other affiliates across the Big Bend and into West Florida. There are lots of rural counties where people have nothing. So the peer attendance has been extraordinary, and in fact, we even get some folks dropping in from other states. We have a landing page that's called NAMISupportgroups.org. And if you go on Google and Google NAMISupportgroups.org, you're going to get to our landing page and end up in our support group meeting, as we have discovered. On the other hand, the families are not so much attending support group. And we've talked with other affiliates around the state, and that seems to be everybody's experience. And we're speculating that it might be because they are there at home with their loved one who has mental illness. And it's just not a great setting to be sitting on the computer in a support group when this loved one is maybe right across the room. I mean, there just is no, one of the beauties of support group is it gives you a little space for yourself where you can, you know, really just vent a little bit to people who understand what's going on. The peers, you know, they're all over the place. They love this stuff, but the family members, not so much. We're doing a lot of marketing and publicity, trying to make sure people know we're available. We do have a statewide network of affiliates who are offering these opportunities online, and that list and the links to those meetings are on the NAMI Florida website. Everybody's working really hard to just at least keep people, I don't know, okay. It's almost like dealing with someone who is having some suicidal ideations, and the whole idea is let's be safe for now. Let's get through the night kind of a feeling. We're not mental health service providers. We're not professional psychologists or psychiatrists or social workers. We're just peers with lived experience. And I am a family member. I have a son who has a mental health condition. So I am trained to facilitate the family support group. And I've seen this in the folks that show up. And I'll say, one thing I've learned, it seemed like everybody was saying 10 years ago, everything in the world is going to be online. We're going to be on our computers. We're all stuck in our screens. For me, I have learned that that's not for me. I really want to get back to in-person contact with people. So we are hoping, crossing our fingers, that within the next few months, maybe we can get back to that. But it's like Dr. Carrioth said, nobody has any idea what's going to happen. We're just trying to hold it in the road.
And like you said, Nancy, despite all of the cyber connectivity we have now, we remain social animals. That one-to-one human connection is so doggone important. Except if you don't have that connection, you can always go not even online, although you can. But the telephone has been a staple of providing referral service since the days of the old suicide hotline, Randy Nicholas, which is how 211 Big Ben got its start for those of us who've been around for a little bit. Here. What's your call volume like since this thing has hit? Are you guys going crazy, or is it just kind of nominal, or what are you seeing?
We started seeing an increase in March, and we're up about 65% call rate.
Wow.
We answered just over 2,000 calls in March and over 2,000 calls in April, and we're on track to do that again this month. We also answer, in addition to 211 calls, which cover the whole gamut, helping people with finding referrals to community services all the way to suicide prevention. We also answer the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline for callers that call from the North Florida area. And we saw a little bit of uptick on those calls too, not as dramatic as a percentage, but we are starting to see now some of the suicide prevention calls getting a little bit more intense, and people's anxieties coming out a little bit differently as we go through these months. So, but we're here, we're trying to help keep all the information about community resources up to date. I have a good team of staff doing that, and we have counselors on our hotline that are answering in our call center. We couldn't do it remotely because our phone system wasn't able to allow that. But we fortunately are getting some funds from a couple of our funders to upgrade our telephone system. And in a few months, we will be able to go remote in case this continues or it reoccurs, as people say it might. So we're doing a lot of different things to help the community, helping a lot of people, staying in touch with our community partners, and especially people looking for food, for financial assistance, for housing, emergency housing. Those are a good number of our callers are looking for those things, as well as dealing with anxiety.
You're listening to Perspectives, and also if you are viewing it online, watching Perspectives from WFSU Public Media, talking about mental health concerns in the era of COVID-19. Jay Reeve, president and CEO of the Appalachie Center, also Nancy O'Farrell, executive director of NAMI Tallahassee, Randy Nicholas, who we just heard from, president of 211 Big Bend, and Sally Carrioth, the faculty member at the Florida State University College of Nursing. And your business card must be the size of an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, Sally Carrioth, because you have so many things that you have done and continue to do. And one of those is certainly grief counseling. Are we seeing overwhelming grief for a way of life that may be gone forever? Is it too early to start seeing that? Or do you have experience with that here, especially with the students?
Well, a couple of things. None of us know what's going on. And so by virtue of that, people are holding pretty steady. The two emotions I say are always associated with grief are mad and sad, and we're seeing a great divide with exactly that. The people who are so angry about the idea of wearing a mask or staying inside, that's really grief. And those of us that are trying to stay inside, I say that to and my private patients too, but I say, if there's anything you can do, why don't you look at how you can globally help with this? If you don't know what the right answer is, then err on the side of caution and think of it as a gift to the world or to your next door neighbor. I've started baking and dropping off cookies at every place in the neighborhood every day, because we can't do it for the world, but we can do it for the people that we're connected with. Nancy, I think you've probably seen this too. I have several friends that have children with mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And they are really struggling with the loss of their routine. Mm-hmm. And the idea that they have to stay inside, that they can't just go to the neighbors, that their job can no longer be accessed. And the frustration is growing and growing. And they're, in some situations, they're trashing the house because they're so frustrated. Well, we're all at kind of that same level, only really in a much minor way. The idea that we are so used to just getting to do whatever we wanted. I have turned into a cleaning maniac. My house has never been cleaner. I'm down to wiping lampshades. But I think it's important that we recognize that for probably this panel, we're inconvenienced. But when I look at the students who log on to give their speeches, I can see that they're living in really abject poverty, that there may be 7 or 8 people in the house, that food is an issue, mm-hmm. that we who are not in that situation need to be so aware of these Maslow. You can't do self-actualization until you've done Maslow. I mean, you don't start at the top, and that this whole issue of grief is kind of substituted by trying to get by each day. And I think, like Jay said and Rand, all of you have said, we're going to see this as time marches on. When I have a sister who's a scientist and is at the University of Minnesota and the labs that are working on a vaccine. But that's not happening tomorrow. That's probably not happening until 2021. As a scientist, I would tell you that. Mm-hmm. All of my former medical students and nursing students who are writing to me each day with their little faces all bunged up because they've been wearing masks. And they will say things like, Dr. Carrieth, is it going to be okay? And none of us have the answer to that. What we have the answer to is get up each day and do the best you can. This is not the time to shame someone because they're not learning a new skill. For all of us that wake up each day and put one foot in front of the other.
Right.
What I tried to talk the university into, which I wasn't very successful for, is just giving everybody that's a university student in spring an A and calling it even because of the challenges. I did that. And John Thrasher, are you listening? I wouldn't have cared if they ever handed in a thing by virtue of the fact that they were still online and talking every day. And so the idea that we're supposed to be better people because of this is, in my mind, arrant nonsense. We're just saying to everybody, the idea that we can't even put our arm around someone and say, how you doing? Hugging our children. Amanda Carrieth has been unbelievable. She has locked me down. The idea that we don't have a game plan. There is no coach in this. And so everybody needs to be rewarded for doing the best they can.
Well, Jay Reeve, does that change the equation to the perception that the caregivers, the experts, the people who know, who have the background and all of that are now just as at sea as the average person because none of us have been through that. Does that minimize the effectiveness of whether it's mental health counseling or any other kind of distribution of expertise? Or does it just, kind of, we have to raise our game somewhat in order to deal with this circumstance here?
I think it's really interesting. It's a really interesting point. I'm thinking of kind of what we've gone through as an agency and what every direct care agency has gone through. Because for Appalachian Center, we didn't shut our doors or reduce our volume at all. We couldn't. We're essential healthcare providers. So I have staff, actually I have about 200 of our staff who work in either residential programs or inpatient programs who continued to come to work every day. And we had some folks who were, we had some folks who got sick. Fortunately, none of it was COVID, but we were all really cautious about what was going on with them. And in a place like Appalachian Center in the inpatient units, you have generally 8 to 10 new clients every day coming in from the street, coming in from emergency rooms, coming in from law enforcement. And you generally don't know what that's going to be like. It's our staff's job and our clinician's job to figure out what's going on with those patients to help them to start to feel better and start to feel stable. this added an entirely different layer to it, because historically there's a pretty clear dividing line between patients that we can manage their physical illnesses and patients we can't. And if we can't manage their physical illnesses in our setting, then we'll, you know, work with TMH or CRMC to get them managed there. This was a whole new ballgame for all of us in terms of the assessment, in terms of the anxiety that the clients were bringing in. But to Sally's point, I think this is, goes to what you're saying, the other thing that we sort of had to manage was our own anxiety, the anxiety that the staff had, the anxiety that the folks who administrators had about what's going to happen now, what's the best tack to take, what's the best strategy, but also what's going to happen to us. And I had conversations with more than a few nurses and psych techs and doctors who had that concern. I'm going to come to work today. I'm going to be masked. I'm going to take the precautions I can, but I'm not, people aren't getting met in hazmat suits. And so what does this mean, putting myself at risk in the front lines? And I'll tell you, I think that our folks, and I think this is true for healthcare workers in general, our folks did a terrific job of stepping up to the plate. We saw very few call outs. We saw very few people who said, you know, I'm sorry, I can't handle this. I can't come in. And I think in the long run, actually, even in the medium run, having a job to do that you know how to do and a structure within which to do it was in some ways helpful, right? Because that's the thing about healthcare. On the front, in some ways you're on the front lines, but you're also surrounded by some pretty talented nurses and doctors, both in terms of primary care and psychiatry. Those are the people you work with every day. So you've kind of got a team around you where if you are trying to manage what this means in a restaurant or a bank or a place where you're not embedded within a healthcare setting, I think in some respects that's probably more anxiety provoking. So I think folks leaned on the structure of their work a lot, and that's what got a lot of us through.
Nancy O'Farrell, you kind of alluded to this a little bit ago with your own situation, that you are ready to get back out there and have interactions yeah. with people and to recover some sort of just, this is the way we deal with each other as people, more face-to-face than cybernetically. But as Jay just indicated, this is one of the first times that I can ever recall that the average person, whether they are that person who checks out customers at Trader Joe's or is out there collecting garbage for the city of Tallahassee or helping to provide healthcare services at TMH or CRMC or whatever, where they have had to deal with the question in the back of their heads, is this the day that I die or that I get on that fast track to death? Mm-hmm. You know, this is almost like a military thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. And we don't, as a general rule at NAMI, you know, ask to see people's diagnosis when they want to access what we do. I think we're getting folks who have perfectly understandable depression, situational anxiety, that you would not ever say have a diagnosed clinical mental illness. I see an uptick in that my son, who does have a mental health diagnosis, who manages it, you know, very well. He takes his meds and he's really good about the things that he has to do to live with it. It's affecting him. He works in the healthcare field and he's terrified every day. And I can see that rising in my siblings. I think in the world, as Dr. Reeve says, we haven't even seen the beginning of the mental health problem. We may be in the middle of the physical illness, but I'm a little pessimistic about what's ahead in terms of folks' mental health. It's hard. It's not the way we're accustomed to living, not just Americans, but all human beings, you know, need personal contact. But the person that you see and touch might make you sick. What is that? It's difficult. I think what Dr. Carrioth said, which is the only thing you can do is just get up every day and do what you do, might not be a great answer, but it's pretty much all we have. And if we stay busy, and I'd like to say, when we're talking about students, we have continued to have a steady flow of FSU and FAMU students who approach us about volunteering. Even with this going on, I wish I had more for them to do because it's so helpful to just do something. But what impressive young people. Aren't we lucky and blessed in this community, I think.
Well, so many nonprofits are always begging for volunteers, and maybe that's, you know, we'll rethink that kind of role too. How do we do that on a safer
Perhaps
basis?
So. Mm-hmm.
But boy, I'm hearing, I don't want to say pessimism, but let's just say guarded non-optimism here. And Randy Nicholas, is there a threat that our resources are not going to be up for this when this kind of different surge that Nancy and Jay and Sally are talking about may hit within the next year or two or three?
Well, I think we're gearing up for, we're trying to get some funding for some additional crisis counselors starting in the summer. We're working with our 2-in-1 partners around the state and DCF to apply for some FEMA funding. But that's, you know, 9 months worth of funding. And so I think, you know, in the immediate future, we'll see some increase of potential services, but I'm a little bit worried beyond that because we're going into a lot of economic trials too with how much money we're not bringing into our state and federal government and how much we're spending. So I tend to worry about future services. Now, in terms of the immediate services that people need right now, financial assistance, food, people are stepping up to the plate, but a lot of people need those services and not everybody is getting what they need. So that's going to add to the mental health issues too. So I guess I'm like you, I'm kind of not totally pessimistic, but I'm kind of guarded about what's going to happen. I'm not really sure.
Flip side of that, though, and this is where, Dr. Sally, you can come riding to the rescue, a white horse hooves flying and beautiful banner flapping in the breeze here. Some success stories, though, coming out of here, besides what, of course, you've been doing, trying to maintain that connection to your students and kind of taking them literally under your cyber wing to say, hey, it's okay, I'm here for you, and I care, even as you head out into a pretty uncertain world right now. What are some of the more positive things that you have seen come out of this from your personal viewpoint?
I would say this too, that anytime any of us see someone doing a musical piece, I keep a candle on my front porch that goes on at 8 o'clock every night. And I've done this since day one for my med students, my nursing students, just a solidarity moment. And that every time you see someone doing that, if you're on Facebook, just hit like. Again, Amanda Carrieth Thompson at COCA has been part of the group that's making sure that there is some kind of artistic endeavor online all the time. Each day, a different artist from the city talks about the kinds of things they do. Even if we're not wealthy, even if money is an issue, which it is, certainly I would think for all of us, every time someone has a little fundraiser, give them $5, give them $1. The idea that we support every single thing we see where someone is doing something positive. I am saddened by things that happen in the media where we really put a lot of energy into negative kinds of things. And everybody out there is trying to do it right. Even the folks that are so frightened and so angry, they just don't know what to do. And so this is an expression of what to do when there's nothing to do. And so the idea that we'll walk somebody else's dog or we'll bake for them or we'll pick up somebody's laundry, what we do locally is just as important as what people are doing globally. And I see my students every day doing minor things, cutting someone's grass. I have got a couple students that stayed in town until they're taking their state boards. And they have rounded up all of these names of people that can't go out. And they pick up their little grocery lists and they run errands for them and they won't take a penny for it. And so on any given day, they make rounds and finds out who needs what. And if they go to Walgreens or if they go to Publix or if they go to wherever. And we need as a group, every single time we see someone doing that, to respond positively and to be recognize that we may be in different boats, but we sure are all in this together. And I look at my students. I'm one of the people tapped to go face-to-face in the fall to try it out, to see how it works. I teach in a great big auditorium, and I can put a 30-person class in there and space them enough. And here are kids that have been looking to go to college. It's been their biggest thing in the world their freshman year. And they're just really doing okay with it. And I don't know that we put enough accolades in relation to this. My one big fear is we have a little background about mental health illness following these kinds of things. I'm sure you all, Jay and Randy and Nancy, know there was a lot written after the SARS epidemic, where everybody came in every day. And Jay, you were talking about that your people keep coming to work. What we saw is when the danger passed, that's the group that went to pieces, where they really, what they describe in therapy is true trauma. You can't go to work every day thinking you're going to die without it having to take a toll. There's a wonderful book called And the Body Keeps Score. There are lots of people going in the front lines who already have suffered profound trauma. And when these kinds of things reoccur, the trauma reoccurs. And I think they're still going to work every day. But I agree with Randy and Jay and Nancy that I think we're going to see a large meltdown of sorts when what we refer to as the danger passes. I think as mental health practitioners, our job hasn't really started yet.
Yeah, a good friend of mine who did that, who served multiple deployments in the Middle East and was just a paragon of strength, and his unit looked up to him when everything was going to pieces. He would stand firm and tell everyone what needed to be done, and he was just a total bulwark. He gets back to the States and loses it completely. Mm-hmm. Worst case of PTSD, probably, that most mental health professionals who looked at him had ever seen. And
look at the suicide rate.
Exactly. And Jay, you mentioned that too. Again, caring for the caregivers, and that this is a long-term commitment. It's not 6 months, and we got this thing out of the way. So, again, is it getting outside yourself, like the other folks have intimated, that it is not a total solution to this issue, but it at least kind of takes you off the front burner and allows you to focus on someone else's needs and requirements so that you don't obsess so much about what it's doing to me?
Well, I think it's real interesting. I think there's two different things, right? So for folks who are sheltering in place, for folks who are self-isolating, then yeah, I totally agree with what Sally's talking about. The more you can reach out in that state where you don't have structure, where you don't have a lot of contact, I think that can kind of get people out of the spiral of anxiety that this brings with it, right? I mean, I'm sure everybody who's here on the panel and most of the people we're talking to went through that period of just watching CNN a whole lot to sort of say, oh my God, what's going on? At a certain point, you have to turn the TV off and actually go do some stuff and build some bridges. The flip side of it, and I think it goes exactly to what you guys are talking about. There's a term of art called vicarious traumatization, which is kind of the, and I see Sally smiling over here, folks who are dedicating their lives to working on the front lines, and whether that's in physical health care or mental health care for, you know, years and years on end, there's a toll that takes. And so what we don't know yet with this is what kind of impact is the addition of this stressor for your own physical health going to have on top of the day-to-day routine of dealing with people, you know, in the case of our organization, who are suffering from severe psychiatric crises. And so I think the answer there is going to be, we have to keep watch on this, and I feel like for our agency, we have to keep in pretty close touch with the folks who are on the line and doing the on-the-line work. One of the things I do that I've done for many years is that I go roaming around our inpatient units, you know, every couple of days, every week, and boy, I tell you, I have never seen such response from our staff to that as I have over the course of this crisis, because there's this real sense of, oh, okay, you're sort of sharing this with us. And I think that's just, that's symbolic. But what is really needed is for healthcare organizations, whether it's us, TMH, CRMC, 211 in this case, to step forward and make sure that their staff are supported in what they're doing. It's important now. It's going to be crucial 6 months from now, because I think that is when we're going to start seeing this wave of, oh, okay, the worst is over. Oh my God, now I can breathe. And here's the stuff that I've kind of bottled up for months on end.
And also the uncertainties of returning to a normalcy that may not look still like the normal that came before. Again, Nancy O'Farrell, we don't know. We can't project that right now.
That's correct. And we have some concerns about kids, about little kids in middle school age and adolescents. Mm-hmm. I've got grandchildren, so I have some personal concerns about that. I'm not sure we've paid close enough attention to the effect on children, because it doesn't seem like physically they're as ill as adults are. Mm-hmm. But that price, I'm afraid, will be paid for a while if we're not really vigilant and alert to that. And I am happy to say that we do have with NAMI at the national level a wonderful online class that's called NAMI Basics on Demand, which is for parents and primary caregivers of children who have mental health issues. Don't have to have a diagnosis, just issues. And I am really hoping that they're seeing a stream of folks signing up for and taking that course. It's free. And I'm also certified to teach that because of my own history as a mom. And I think parents are really going to need a lot of support. I'm not sure that we're really planning for that very well, trying to be very careful with my language here. In our concern for education, we might be, what I wanted to tell my grandchildren was, don't worry about the rest of school. You're going to miss the last 6 weeks of school or the last 8 weeks of school. It's okay. It'll be okay. It's, as Sally was saying, just give everybody an A.
It's just school.
That's right. Pat them on the head and say, we know you're doing the best you can. But is there some educational stress out there. That kind of worries me a little bit too. We don't really have programs for kids under the age of 18, but we do work with parents. So hopefully we'll be able to help there a little bit too.
Randy Nicholas, you have, I don't want to say an embarrassment of riches available through 211 Big Bend, but you have so many different resources you can connect callers to, particularly if they know what they need. What about the folks who just, I never thought I'd be in this situation, but I need to talk to someone, and I heard this 211 thing, he may, at least help me somehow, but I still don't know what I need. How do your folks unpack those kinds of calls?
Well, first, we're there 24 hours a day. We always have trained counselors available to help, and they can provide some assessment, not in depth, but they can talk to the caller. They have a lot of good active listening skills, and they can help uncover what the callers are feeling, thinking, needing, and, build a connection, build a relationship. And then as that goes on, the conversations kind of open up to the various needs that people didn't know they had or needed and didn't know we could help with. But as we talk to them, that opens doors for other referrals we can offer to community resources. And just talking it through is often a relief for the people that call us. Just having someone there that listens, being non-judgmental. We're not telling people what they should do. We're giving them the opportunity to sort it out, but helping them through that process. So We do help a lot of people with a lot of things they didn't know they were going to call and get help for, but we find that they need these things and we offer that type of assistance.
We all have probably heard that line, I got to talk to somebody, you know, and I can't call my mom, you know, she's so judgmental or whatever else, but I need someone to provide that kind of bouncing off of function, if you will, Randy. So that's good to know that your folks are at least, that isn't unexpected. Someone will call up and say, I don't know what I need, but I had to talk to somebody.
That's right. What I want to say is we all need to take care of ourselves. Just as that previous conversation about worrying about everybody, we have to learn what we're telling ourselves and not worry about things that we don't have any control over and agonize over it, but to try to take care of ourselves from a physical perspective, a mental health, a nutrition, all the things that go into a good lifestyle. We just need to keep focusing on taking care of ourselves so we can be there to help others.
Yeah. But Dr. Sally Carioth, martyrdom feels so wonderful.
But it takes an awful toll. And martyrdom often is associated with victim mentality. And that's a real slippery slope. We're all going along the path and we're all falling into the weeds, but our goal is to get ourselves back on the path. We're not the only people in the world that have ever had terrible things happen. This is really a complex moment. And we in Florida are looking at a hurricane season and we are looking at a lot of other things that come along. And so our only thing that we can do at any given time is to get off the wheel. if you're always what Randy was talking about, if you're always trying to think, you know, what do I do now? Or what about this? If that's how you are in everyday life, this must be agonizing. And I thought for a while, well, the introverts are probably really excited about this. But even with their nesting phenomena, Nancy, you're right. There has to be some human contact. If you look at what happened in World War II with the babies that developed a failure to thrive, they were fed, they were kept dry, and then they all began to lose weight because nobody was rockabying them. And right now, we all probably just need a rockabye.
Boy, that's the truth.
I need my blanket. Folks, we have just a couple minutes left and in about a 30-second wrap-up or so, starting with you, Jay Reeve from the Appalachian Center. Any final thoughts that you have as we bring this in for a landing today?
Sure. Well, it's been a pleasure, as always, to be on and to talk with such a great panel here. There's a lot of really, really great stuff going on in this region when it comes to healthcare. There's a lot of cooperation. There's a lot of team effort, which you really don't see in other places. And that's particularly true in the mental health world. So, you know, one of the things, and I'll just mention this real quickly, there is an organization called the Mental Health Council of the Big Bend that Nancy and Randy and I all sit on. And one of the things that's been real interesting in this crisis, especially when it first hit, we kind of threw out the possibility of meeting less frequently. And the folks on that council, it's 25 organizations that work real closely with the mental health world and, you know, the content experts, folks with lived experience. And everybody kind of said, no, you know, we need to meet more frequently. We need to start meeting once a week just to find out what's going on and just to support each other, which we did for a while until, you know, everybody's Zoom schedule got too overwhelming. But I think that kind of goes to the point that in this community, when times get tough, we kind of pull together, which I think is kind of cool. So that's my final thought.
Thank you, Jay. Nancy O'Farrell, NAMI Tallahassee.
Oh, we have definitely discovered that with the new and very strong alliance that we have with NAMI Bay County, NAMI Okaloosa Walton, and NAMI Pensacola.
Cool.
Before this happened, I really did not even know the program coordinators and those affiliates. I had very little to do with them. Now we have got a really great network that really covers our whole managing entity region, all the way from Madison to the Alabama border and north to Georgia. And we are collaborating and cooperating sharing resources, and that's going to continue. That's an actual change in the way we operate as a result of this. So there, actually, folks, there are little silver linings everywhere. I mean, just the reduction in traffic has been nice, I have to say. Although it's heating back up again, but we've discovered, you know, maybe we don't need to shop as much. Maybe we don't need some Zoom meetings are a good idea. Maybe not all Zoom, but there are things that we can do from home that are okay. We've learned that. So I'm by nature an optimist, and I am really hoping that we come out of this on the other side. We don't drag all those old bad things with us, that we actually do maybe improve the world a little bit as a result of this. I'm hoping, just hope.
Thanks for
always
the positivity,
hope. There's
Nancy.
Always hope. That's what we say in NAMI. There's always hope.
Always hope. Randy Nicholas, 211 Big Bend.
Well, I just wanted to reiterate, we have counselors 24 hours a day. And just pass the word, let people know that 211 is available. We're helping a lot of people, and we want to help as many people as we can. But people need to know about our service and our number. And one of our big efforts going on right now is promoting our services, especially through social media. So please help pass that word.
Thanks so much, Randy. And Dr. Sally Cariotti, you get the final say today.
I guess it's this, that we don't have the answers, but someday they'll have the answers. And I'd like to think that all the choices that we've made now makes that easier.
Beautifully put. Thanks so much, Sally. And thanks to our entire panel here, our Mental Health Consortium today, here on Perspectives on Air and Online, produced by WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. Thanks going out to Taylor Cox, Paul Dam, Amy De Villegas, Trisha Moynihan, and Lydell Rawls, Director of Content. Kim Kelly sets up our program interface and keeps everything cooking right along. And I'm Tom Flanagan. We invite you back again next week. More thought-provoking conversation here on Perspectives from WFSU Public Media. Please take care.
For more information about Perspectives and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org.